Thank you very much, Henrietta. And it's wonderful to be back here in Bochum again. It's pretty much 3 years since I was here. So thank you for the invitation, and thank you to the invitation from the Department of Media Studies as well.
And I leave you here on your
Okay.
own, yeah.
Okay.
You manage.
I'll manage. I'll manage with my display console here. I'm just gonna move myself slightly. I've got so many devices in front of me right around the corner. So yeah, and thank you for that introduction as well, Henry. I'm gonna before I begin, I was just thinking there as you were talking about Astrida Numanus's bodies of water, and I'm engaging, thinking through what is, the non-human body. And my talk tonight is very much around, is situated on seaweed, and thinking about that actually as a body. Not that I talk specifically about it, but I think that importance of recognizing that, bodies are human and more than human as well. I thought I'd just, before I sort of dive into the talk in earnest, I'd just give a little bit of context around what my work and my practice is. So I work primarily with photography, but in very much an expanded sense of what photography is. And I work with a lot of experimental photochemical practices, and sometimes those use the things that we think about in relationship to photography, and some as in light, and sometimes they don't. And this is something I will talk about in relation to seaweed this evening. So yeah, my practice, whilst often there are artifacts, if you like, that are the end result, but it's actually very much a process-based practice that I'm interested in, and how I work in relationship to particular sites. So my work is research-based. It's interested in sort of environmental concerns and environmental history, and how this notion that Henry mentioned there, spectral materialism. And this, I use this term, and I'll just speak about it briefly, in the spectral in relationship to time and to history, and then materialism as very much sort of the material presence, and that history, and I should say the past, is very much in the present, and how we find that materialized in different forms. And this, I suppose, is, the crux of what my practice is trying to investigate through different methodologies. So thinking about the haunting of different forms of time. That's and I work with different materials. Tonight I'm going to talk about seaweed and its relationship to media and to photography in particular. But I've also another large research project which is based around the mineral salt in Australia, and thinking how that is also functioning as a form of media. And I'll unpack this a little bit later in terms of how I'm making this association between what we think about natural, if you like, elements such as salt and seaweed, and how we can equate these as forms of media, what the theorist John Durham-Peters talks about as elemental media. But I'll unpack that a little bit later. So yeah, as I say, the work is very much around a sort of a process often, and you will see images that are a sort of outcome of these processes and practices, but it's the process-led aspect that is particularly important to the way. And also to say that the work is a form of collaboration. Sometimes that's collaboration with other humans, and sometimes that's collaboration, as you'll see tonight, with seaweed. But it's kind of seeing how the work that is produced is co-produced as a interaction between myself, being in a particular location that I'm researching. I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing in the Hebrides Islands in Scotland tonight. As I say, sometimes that's in Australia, in the desert there. But there's these common themes throughout. So let's begin with seaweed. And tonight's talk is going to set out why I think seaweed's amazing, and setting out some of the framework for that, and its relationship with, as a as carbon capture and how it's often spoken about, well, the ocean is spoken about the blue as a blue lung and how its relationship with oxygen, but also how it's capturing large amounts of carbon dioxide and sort of, you know, how we can think about it as a step towards mitigating, and it's a step, a small step, but a step towards mitigating climate change and its importance. So yeah, I'll set out around why seaweed is amazing, but then developing this relationship between seaweed and media, and specifically from my practice, photography. And then, as I say, I'm going to talk through some field work that I've been doing in the Hebrides that was going on towards the end of last year, and we'll continue on next year. So really, this is sort of an opportunity, and again, thanks to Henrietta for giving this opportunity to think with and through bodies of water. So we begin in the ocean, where they say all life on Earth started. Water engulfs your body, posed between submersion and the sense of floating freely. You are many, moving down through the water, feeling the planet's gravity pulling. It's reassuring, an anchor in an ocean of uncertainty. It gives a sense of security. At the base of your body is a holdfast. It is the place and the position from where you strive onwards in the evolution of life. You stretch upwards from this reassuring anchor through the cold water, towards the warmth of the sun, as your fronds sense the light and the sun's energy above. You reach upwards towards the surface of the ocean, where you know you can photosynthesize, where your sensitized molecules become transfixed by the light. You draw in the sun's energy. Your species has been doing this for billions of years. We are holding fast, imagining there for a moment what it might be like to be seaweed attached to a substrate by a holdfast. And a holdfast is a root-like system that exists at the bottom, at the base, I should say, of the seaweed plant. And it does what it says. It holds fast. The name holdfast indicates a function. It holds fast to a rock, a shell, wood, and even plastic debris. It holds fast to anything that provides security and stabilization within the continuous movement of the ocean. The word is a description of the action. At times, we all need to hold fast. Seaweeds are an ancient organism known as microalgae, first appearing on the Earth over 1 billion years ago. These strange otherworldly life forms cover 3 million square kilometers of the Earth's oceans, sensing and storing vast amounts of information about their environment in their flexible cells. They use this knowledge to adapt and adjust to changing habitats, such as water temperature, salinity, the intensity of sunlight, and wave density. The seaweed's ability to sense and store information provides a critical biomarker for environmental and climate change. For example, climate events affecting water temperature or changes to nutrient levels can lead to excessive growth or die-off in seaweed colonies. Seaweeds also function as indicators for micropollutants, including plastics and heavy metals, ocean acidification, and climate change more broadly. Over millennia, this sensing information has shaped individual seaweed species' morphology and their chemical structure. We could almost say that seaweeds are an archive of planetary evolution, with something like a billion-year-old history inscribed within their morphology. Sensing environmental conditions is one aspect of their function. Another is their ability to sense and store sunlight. Like terrestrial plants, which began as a branch of green microalgae that moved onto land, seaweeds thrive by photosynthesis, using chlorophyll to capture and store different wavelengths of sunlight, which in turn are transformed into energy, glucose, and oxygen. In this self-sustaining, life-dependent process of photosynthesis, which literally means making things with light, seaweeds enter into a symbiotic relationship with the planet, giving in return things that are urgently needed, oxygen, and functioning as a vast carbon sink. It's estimated that marine algae are responsible for producing 70 to 80% of the oxygen in the planet's atmosphere. Little wonder the ocean is referred to as the blue lungs of the planet. Along with its ability to absorb sunlight and transform it into oxygen, seaweeds also suck considerable amounts of carbon dioxide out of the Earth's atmosphere. In a process known as carbon sequestration, the CO2 is transformed into energy-rich carbon compounds that are stored in the plant's stripe, the long, actually what you can see here, the stripe, in its fronds, in its bladder, and in its holdfast. Carbon is literally fixed into the algae's, into the seaweed's tissue by photosynthesis, remaining there until the plant dies and the organic matter containing the carbon sinks to the ocean floor. Seaweeds capture carbon at a scale that far outstrips the capacity of terrestrial plants and their capacity as a capacity as a carbon sink. According to Emily Pidgington, Senior Director in Strategic Marine Initiatives at Conservation International, marine ecosystems, which include seaweeds, mangroves, and salt marshes, absorb carbon at rates 50 times greater than terrestrial forests. So you can see it's a very important avenue for being able to function as a carbon sink, the ocean and the marine ecosystems. With 2/3 of the surface of the planet covered by water, seaweeds by water and seaweed said to be capable of capturing almost 200 million tons of carbon dioxide each year. It is little surprise, with the urgency of climate change and climate crisis, I should say, the scientific and environmental community has recognized seaweeds as a crucial blue carbon sink that might help mitigate climate change. Seaweeds' capacity for photosynthesis to sense, capture, store, and transform sunlight makes carbon capture possible. These capacities make it possible to also think about seaweed as a type of photographic medium. So, seaweed and photography. Seaweed's ability to photosynthesize, the idea that algae are making things with light, as I say, photosynthesis literally means this making things with light. Seaweed's ability to photosynthesize is something that can be thought in relationship to the process of photography, which also makes things with light, images. In general terms, seaweed and photographic images need light to exist. They modulate light for a particular outcome. One is to live, the seaweed's ability to thrive, and one, as we know, is to make images. Seaweeds thrive by drawing energy from light. A sensitized photographic surface literally draws an image out of light. As well as their shared need for light, seaweed and analog photography are chemically entangled. The chemicals derived from seaweed saturate the material history of photochemistry. From Daguerre's use of iodine fumes to generate photosensitive surfaces in 1839, to the inclusion of sodium carbonate as an ingredient in many aspects of photochemistry used today. And both iodine and sodium carbonate have long been extracted from seaweed. And you'll hear a little bit more about that in shortly when I talk about the work that I've been doing in the Hebrides. So placing seaweed and photography in the same media ecology destabilizes the boundary between nature and culture and natural and technological media. And this is really to work with this expanded notion or expanded definition of what media is. And that's certainly something that I'm doing in my practice from seaweed to salt, to thinking about how can we not only think of media as something that is anthropogenic, that's produced by humans, but actually is a form that can be forms of elemental media. The argument for recognizing elements of the natural environments of forms of media follows a growing body of environmental media theory championed by John Durham Peters in his book, The Marvelous Clouds, where he suggests tree rings, ice cores, clouds, and geological formations record, store, and transmit data information in the way that we might traditionally ascribe only to anthropogenic media. This is also, I know some of you have been reading Melody Dew's work on the wild blue media and oceanic media, and thinking about how the ocean is functioning as a form of media. And Melody Dew is sort of saying, well, what this does is a way of erasing, or perhaps not erasing, but resituating ourselves. So pre-existing conceptions of media mediation undergo a sort of radical transformation and a recalibration. So we're, you know, as we talked about in the session earlier today, for those of you that are here, of like, how do we reposition ourselves and to become unfamiliar with the familiar? And this really is kind of Melody Dew's claim for the ocean, but also John Durham Peters in his arguments around elemental media as well. So for Peters, the environment is media when it demonstrates a function similar to human-made technologies of storage and transmission. And in Melody Dew's essay, The Media of Seaweed Between the Kelp Forest and the Archive, she applies this to seaweed. And here Dew is suggesting that seaweeds are media by looking at the role light, and not only light, but saturation, plays in the ontology of both seaweed and photography. Dew uses the example of cyanotypes, an early photographic process that relies on sunlight, but also chemical saturation for making images, to claim that saturation in the cyanotype, and here's an example of one that I've made with seaweed. It's to claim that saturation in the cyanotype process, but of course also in other, especially photochemical processes, methods, and that it links it to the life cycle of seaweeds, providing this link between seaweed and photography. To unfold this is understanding how saturation transforms both seaweed and photography, a process involving water, chemicals, oxygen, and light. This is an image of Anna Atkins, who you might be familiar with, who was really the first person to make cyanotypes. I mean, she didn't invent it. John Herschel invented the process of cyanotypes, but Anna Atkins was a botanist who was studying seaweed and plants, and she wanted another way, rather than making illustrations or making pressings, to make she made this book of photography called Photographs of British Algae, and it's a series of reproductions, I suppose, of seaweed using the cyanotype process. So for those of you that are not sort of familiar with what cyanotypes are, and they're something that's becoming more and more popular and repopular, I should say. Making a cyanotype requires a base paper to be saturated with potassium ferrocyanide and ferric ammonium citrate, two chemicals, making this light sensitive surface. Then following an exposure to sunlight, soaking the paper in running water fixes the image and stops it from disappearing. It's also what? It's the water, the running of water, that gives it the characteristic blue that cyanotypes are known by. So as I say, Anna Atkins was one of the first to use this process in the 1840s, and further provides this entanglement between photography and seaweed. So keeping with the theme of saturation, saturation takes place at multiple scales and magnitudes for seaweed. Oceans become increasingly acidic from atmospheric carbon absorption. Pathogens contaminate and cause disease to seaweeds. One recent example some of you might have read about is a flesh-eating bacteria that has infected large swathes of seaweed, the species Sargassum, it's called, and these are washing up on the beaches infected by this particular bacteria that is flesh-eating, and the seaweed is literally saturated by this bacteria. But also, industrial waste is frequently emptied into the ocean. Toxins and pollutants are saturating ocean habitats where seaweeds exist. In these situations, the seaweeds experience states of saturations. They're impacted on a material level by external chemicals that can lead to change and transformation, including modifications to their morphology, or decline in their general health, and shifts in seaweed population and distribution. As these events continue, and as Melody Dew astutely points out in her essay, Linking Photography and Seaweed Again, seaweeds may offer, quote, this is Melody's writing, seaweeds may offer their own snapshots or photographic negatives of climate change that index anthropogenic activity, end of quote. Photography, particularly in its chemical form, is a saturated media. Cyanotypes, of course, are not the only photographic medium that involves saturation to bring around change and transformation. Saturation is a prerequisite for many photographic materials that allow images to appear. And in, you know, I'm talking a lot on photochemistry or analog photography, but not only. So yeah, it's so that's in relation to the chemicals needed for preparing papers, such as salt and silver nitrate, to the coating of films with silver halide emulsions and gelatines, and the subsequent development of these materials in photochemistry. In digital photography, image processing software and countless smartphone apps provide multiple ways to adjust the saturation of color and light images viewed on the screen. The saturation of pigments and ink become another essential question or quality in digital printing technologies. As I said, why I think seaweeds are amazing, and all the various different ways and what they're doing in the world and how they're functioning, and sort of mapping out this relationship between seaweed, media, and particularly photography, through both photography and seaweed's relation to light, through photosynthesis for the seaweed, for as making something with light, its very body, and it's thriving for life, and then photography's relationship to light. I now want to sort of turn this into relation to how I'm working with this in my own practice, and this practice of what I'm calling attuning to the politics and poetics of seaweed. And You know, I've been showing various images in the background. These are from my practice, this practice that I'm going to talk about called paraphotomancy, where I'm working with the chemicals of seaweed in relationship to photochemistry and silver halides that exist within sheets of photographic film. And I'll talk about that process as we go. But let's move now into really this sort of how I'm working with it and a particular site of field work that I've been working with. The tangled media ecology of seaweed and photography is a site of art-based research and field work in my artistic practice. I'm fascinated by how both photography and seaweed are sensitized media that capture and store information in their different ways, and how thinking of them as a media ecology can illuminate environmental and cultural histories about seaweed in the geographic locations where I work. Over the last few years, I've been exploring the photochemical potential of seaweed as a creative methodology to focus on climate change, biodiversity and sustainability in marine environments in Norway and Scotland. As I said, most of the images that I've shown are resulting from that field work. Up to this point, they were images that were made, and I stopped there kind of, I call them images and I don't call them photographs because they're not made with light, as you'll hear. They're made through a chemical interaction. But most of those, what you've seen to date, are from a field work that I was doing on a small island in Norway 2 or 3 years ago. But now I'm going to focus more on work that I've been doing more recently in the Hebrides in Scotland. And I want to talk about what I think about as an alchemical photographic practice. And I use this word alchemical because it's this relationship between chemistry and photography, but there's this sort of there's an unknownness about it, or an uncertainty about it. Again, this uncertainty that we spoke about earlier today and not being sure what will emerge and how do we position ourselves differently. But this alchemical photographic practice and how I weave that together with the material history of photochemistry and the cultural history of seaweed harvesting in the Scottish Hebrides. The research includes looking at how changes in demand, technology, and implementation of industrial scale extraction of seaweeds may affect the sustainability of marine environments in the region, comparing this with the historical practices once used to harvest seaweed in the Scottish Hebrides in the 18th century. Here, seaweed becomes a sensory device of another kind, not only registering climatic and environmental events within their molecular structure, but as a medium that communicates stories, cultural histories and speculations about possible futures. You know, these are the things we think about as media in itself, as something that that communicates, and thinking not only then as the seaweed as holding within its molecular structure this archive of planetary change, but actually then how is it mediating these other stories, more contemporary stories, even if we're talking about the sort of 18th and 19th century of practices of harvesting seaweed, but also how we can work with seaweed as this creative methodology to think through speculative futures of what might take place. So to interpret the first, that is the molecular structure and what's held within the seaweed, attends to the evidence-seeking demands of science, and to attune to the second, to this the material history and the cultural history that can be communicated by working through these process-based modes with seaweeds is the work of a poetics. However, I would claim to perceive and decode both forms of sensing are entangled and span environmental, material, political, and aesthetic worlds. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the fieldwork that I did in the Hebrides, and I'm going to talk about it from a situated perspective, as if I'm there now, really, and describing that to you. I arrived by ferry to Tiree, a small island in the Scottish Hebrides. Here we are at the top of the UK, the island, the complex sort of island of the Hebrides. You have the Outer Hebrides, you've got the Inner Hebrides, and Tiree is somewhere, well, it's not somewhere, it's here in the sort of the mid-range of the Hebrides. It's 6 hours by ferry from Oban. So it's not an easy place to get to. And it's as you'll hear, it's quite a wild and beautiful place. It's the start of winter. It's the start of winter. The tourists that the island relies on have now left for the season. And with them, the two cafes that are on the island have closed. All that's left is one small food shop, a lot of sheep, a lot of seaweed, and a lot of wind. I sense I've arrived in a place that is beautiful and bleak in equal measures. To the west of Tiree, are 2,000 miles of rolling ocean. The next landfall is North America. The island is mostly flat. There are very few hills and no trees to speak about. The island in its Gaelic name, and I'm not going to try and pronounce it because I can't, but it when it's translated, it means the island whose top lies below the waves. So there's no trees. It's a very low land island, and there's no trees because of the level of wind that's coming off the ocean. But this island whose top lies below the waves is a name that conjures an image of a submerged land that's made as much of water as it is of solid ground. The ocean around the Hebrides is home to vast kelp forests and many other species of seaweed. Kelp is one form of seaweed, what we know as the large brown fronds that it is one of many species of seaweed. The plentitude that once fueled the island's kelp industry, this was a plentitude that once fueled the island's kelp industry, filling the pockets of estate owners who benefited from this valuable trade. The brutal weather that the island experiences makes landfall on the west of the island, coming directly off the Atlantic. It is here I stay, not far from the foundations of the old seaweed factory in Middleton. My abode is a traditional crofter's cottage. I feel grateful for the thick stone walls, small windows, and the traditional thatched roof that protects me from the elements. In the 18th century, it was structures like these that not only the permanent inhabitants of Tiree lived, but also the many seasonal workers that came to harvest seaweed. You're seeing the remnants of the kelp forests that are breaking against the shore. Like many who have journeyed to Tiree by boat, I have come in search of seaweed. I intend to use my time here to attune to the politics and poetics of seaweed, to turn my attention to the material history of seaweed harvesting and kelp production that took place on the island more than 200 years ago. It's a material history that tends to be invisible, leaving little trace in the landscape of the difficult task of cutting, drying, and transporting the seaweed that so many workers carried out. These are some of the archive images I found of that particular industry and time, and we really see it as a sort of back-breaking work that took place. I'm learning seaweeds have stories to tell, and finding ways of attuning and responding to these takes practice. It requires slowing down and tuning in to different visual and temporal registers. It involves looking for how the past saturates the present. I like the word attunement because it suggests a willingness to let stories, narratives, and relations inform and transform an experience and understanding of place. In my practice, this mode of attuning evolves working with experimental photochemical techniques that harness the internal chemistry of seaweed to produce something akin to photographic images. It's an exploratory proposition, guided by the materials I work with, the environment, and the socio-cultural narratives of that particular place that I'm working. So in this practice of attuning in the island of Tyree, I walk the shorelines, noticing how different species of seaweed populate the coastlines, from the large remnants of kelp forest ripped from their holdfasts and washed up on the sand to the west, to the colonies of bladderwrack, another species of seaweed, that are holding fast to the rocky outcrops in more sheltered spots on the island. Like those that came before, I'm searching out the phytochemicals, so the plant chemicals, the phyto of the seaweed, that's contained within these ancient algae. Chemicals that I will draw on to make experimental photographic images, imprints or traces of the seaweed. And I work through those terms of images, imprints, traces, because actually I'm not even sure what I want to call them. They're not photographs, but they're this trace of the seaweed itself, as you can see on the screen. So this material history of seaweed. Seaweed and Tyree, the island of Tyree, have a tangled relationship that brought fortune and destitute to those involved in the kelp industry in the Hebrides at the end of the 18th century. During this period, many travelled to Tyree and other islands in the Hebrides looking for employment when seaweed was recognised as a valuable resource in the chemical industry, particularly in the production of glass and soap. And again, we see some of those that were involved in the harvesting and collection of kelp and various different seaweeds. From the 1750s onwards, large amounts of seaweed were harvested, burnt, and processed on the island until a sudden decline in value in kelp happened in the 1920s, leading to disastrous consequences for those who relied on kelping, as it was known. So as I mentioned earlier, kelp is a species of brown seaweed, but in the context of the Hebrides, kelp or kelping was known as the process of both harvesting, gathering, and then burning the kelp, the seaweed, so it would render this particular chemical sodium carbonate. So it refers to the finished product kelp in this way, an industrial alkali taking the form of a hard crystalline mass derived from drying and firing several kilos of seaweed. I mean, we can see in this the images here, you know, there's piles upon piles of seaweed that are needed to make this alkaline that will become then used in glass and soap and other industrial processes at the time. At the height of the kelp industry, workers waded through the sea and gathered seaweed as it washed up on the shoreline, often carrying it over long distances across the rough ground before it was burnt in pits to yield an alkaline extract known as sodium carbonate, a compound which was used in detergents and to make glass, and later became an ingredient in photographic developing agents. It was a lucrative business for a time. Seaweed transformed the human settlement and fortitudes of the Hebrides. It was labour-intensive industry that brought people from all over Scotland and beyond for the available work. Yet, like the tide, the markets turned, and by the mid-1920s, sodium carbonate was found more cost-effective if extracted in other ways. The result was economic collapse of an industry that had provided employment and homes for thousands of people in the Hebrides. The landlords of the crofts, the farms where the workers lived, couldn't sustain the fall in income, and many ended up clearing the lands as large tracts of land were turned over to livestock grazing. It was catastrophic for the workers and islanders of the Hebrides, resulting in forced immigration in a brutal process which is known as the Highland Clearances, driving tens and thousands of people from their homes. For a short while, the kelp industry, on a much smaller scale, did return to Tyree during the 19th century, when it was discovered that iodine could also be extracted from seaweed and has been used. Iodine is used in medicine. It's also again been used in various photochemical processes. In the Scottish Hebrides, I become a seaweed gatherer, like those that did that 200 years before, searching out the chemicals in these ancient algae. I feel the icy water and the biting wind and rain against my skin. My city hands are already raw from submerging them in the ocean and untangling pieces of seaweed found on the shore that I will use in the photochemical experiments. Like those before, as I said, I seek the chemistry of seaweed, sodium carbonate to be exact, because I found this through a process of experience that this compound will work in this process that I'm using. My method is experimental and, as I say, a little alchemical. Its basis is in photography. However, my approach departs from traditional understandings of photography, which depend on producing images by the transmission of light. Instead, this practice, which I call parophotomancy, works with the chemistry of plants and algae to create something akin to photography. And I call this practice parophotomancy, as in para, meaning something that runs along parallel, along line to, but isn't the thing. And so therefore, it runs along line to photography, but isn't photography. And mancy relates to a form of geomancy. Geomancy is a form of divination or sensing. So it relates to this sensing technology. So we're coming back to media as sensing, but we're also introducing this alchemical, this sort of form of sensing that's outside of perhaps sort of rational knowledge, which is also where sort of alchemy began its form. So I use, as you saw there in the previous images, sheets of photographic film, large format, 5x4 sheets of film. And I fix them by traditional photochemical methods. However, apart from those two aspects, the film itself and using a fixer to capture, to fix the image, there is little typically associated with photography. The images that emerge from a process that's a material encounter between the algae, the seaweed, and the silver contained within the photographic film. The images generated are not representational in the way we think of photographic images depicting or showing something to the human eye that one sat in front of a lens. However, these images are representational in the way they record and mediate a process that has taken place in a particular environment involving various sensing bodies. In this case, the seaweed, salt water, the sheets of film, and me, just to name some of those elements that are in that process. So each day as I'm on the island on Tyree, I collect buckets of seawater and pieces of seaweed that have become separated from their holdfast that route, remember, that where the rough sea and the tide changes have torn the seaweed from its substrate, leaving it floating in the intertidal zone or washed up on the shore. Taking these back to the crofter's cottage where I'm staying, which, as I said, was next to the seaweed factory that once stood, I also set out my tools. So like we saw in the archive images of the tools, I suppose, of 200 years ago to harvest the seaweed, I have my my film and my buckets of water, my tools that work with this material. I soak the seaweed in a solution of seawater and ascorbic acid, basically commonly known as vitamin C, before placing the saturated, we come back to saturated, seaweed onto sheets of photographic film. These processes initiate an alchemical cocktail of alkalines and acids that mimic the way traditional photochemical developers function, but are also suggestive of the pH saturation in ocean ecologies. The interaction of chemicals work as a photographic developer, producing images or impressions on the sheets of film without the need of light. What emerges is always a surprise at the because it's an interaction that depends on chemical reactions taking place on a molecular level between the polyphenols, a compound, as I say, that are produced by plants and algae. And the interaction between the polyphenols in the seaweed and the silver halides that are contained within the photographic emulsion. It works on a formula that's based on a chemical force of attraction and repulsion, a shifting relationship between acid and alkaline. The practice of paraphotomancy attempts to harness the material properties of organic matter to bring about an image where the seaweed writes itself onto a photographic surface. Revealed on the film are images of seaweed, made visible through that chemical saturation and molecular interaction between the seaweed's polyphenols and the silver halide. The results, as I say, they resemble photographic images. However, they are different in the sense that they are created without optics or light. Instead, the chemistry of seaweed generates this para-photographic images. I think of the images not as representing the history of seaweed harvesting that once took place in the Hebrides over 200 years ago, or that they are scientifically evidencing the environmental conditions the seaweeds have emerged from. But instead, these images function as a trace inscribed by my desire to be transformed as I come to know the seaweed on a chemical and material level, enacted through a slow and material process of image making. In this capacity, paraphotomancy is a process-based practice that facilitates conversations and collaborations. Through this practice of attuning to the politics and poetics of seaweed, I learn about the current issues facing the kelp forests in the Hebrides. So as I say, they're these very large forests that are out a little bit further out to sea, and we saw the remnants washed up on the shore. Recently, there has been a renewed interest in seaweed harvesting. It comes with the promise of a blue economy, exploring the algae's use in bioremediation technology and as a biofuel. Seaweed has been shown to be effective at removing or lessening contaminants from aquaculture systems, agriculture and sewerage systems. And there is much speculation about seaweed's potential as a carbon-free fuel for cars and other industries. So seaweed is really this kind of hot property, if you like, at the moment. If the plans go ahead, it will not be harvested by hand like the seaweed gatherers of 200 years ago. It will be an industrial scale extraction involving mechanical dredging equipment that far outstrips the harvesting that took place by hand at the end of the 18th century. If this happens at the scale planned, there's a danger it can potentially harm the region's biodiversity and cause coastal erosion in many of the islands in the Hebrides. Apart from the scale and speed of extraction planned, perhaps there's another significant difference from the way seaweed was harvested all those years ago in the Hebrides. That earlier practice of kelping, and I suggest that we can refer to this as a practice, for it was a craft that involved trial and error. We can suggest it is a practice, for it was a craft that involved trial and error and learning by experience what practice is. It relied on attuning to seaweed species, to the season, to the weather, and to the low spring tides that would bring the right kind of seaweed to shore, enabling gathering to take place more easily. It was also a practice of attuning that had to work in harmony with the complex ecosystem of the region, taking into account the ebb and flow of the ocean, the availability of workforce, the scarcity of food that the sea had to offer, the workforce that was there, as well as the market's demand for sodium carbonate. When industrial-scale extraction of seaweed is envisioned for the Hebrides, one has to wonder if such practices of attunement will be part of future seaweed harvesting. So, we are back in the ocean, wondering how seaweed will hold fast to these changing climates. That brings me to the end of my talk. So thank you very much.
Sorry. Thank you.